Gubbia, the original tent city, had been left largely abandoned after a particularly devastating visitation of the plague in 639. Muawiyah and other Qurayshi warlords like him had not the slightest intention of sharing what they regarded as their patrimony with ragged newcomers from the desert. Syria was theirs, a private fiefdom to be ruled in the manner less of the prophet than of a Ghassanid. That is not to say that Muhammad's teachings were wholly cast aside. Back in Medina, his original capital, leaders of the state that he had founded were desperately struggling to hold together his legacy. Even as the empire palpably began to fragment, with banners of revolt raised in Iran as well as Syria, and a host of Arabs in Egypt rumoured to have accepted belief in Christ, a new emir was succeeding the murdered Uthman. Ali ibn Abi Talib could hardly have been more intimately associated with golden memories of the prophet. At once, both the cousin and the son-in-law of Muhammad, or so tradition reports, he also had a fierce commitment to the primal values of the Ummah, of egalitarianism and brotherhood. As a result, to his admirers, he ranked as a veritable imam, a father to his people, and a lion of God. Far from disdaining emigrants from the desert, Ali regarded them, no matter how hairy or stinking, as his natural constituency. Determined that the Muhajirun should retain their grip on the empire, he opted to abandon Medina and make Kufa his new capital. From there, with the energy of the seasoned general that he was, Ali set himself to stamping his authority on all the Ummah. In order to secure his rear, he first routed an army of rebels outside Basra. Buoyed by this success, he then led the Muhajirun of Kufa up the line of the Euphrates with the aim of taming Syria. A great battle was fought. Muawiyah brought to peace negotiations and victory claimed. Ali, returning to Kufa, naturally made sure to trumpet the news as loudly as he could. The unity of the Ummah, so his propaganda ran, had been triumphantly restored. The fitna, the time of trial, was at an end. Except that it was not. Muawiyah, withdrawing from the Euphrates, coolly began to proclaim a message of victory identical to that of his rival. Even more threatening to Ali's position, however, there were many now in his own ranks who likewise refused to accept him as Amir. His opening of negotiations with Muawiyah and his patching together of a treaty was behaviour that smacked, in their opinion, less of an imam than of some arrogant and self-serving monarch. A true believer, so they argued, would have trusted his fate not to diplomacy, but to ongoing warfare and the will of God. The charge was a crippling one. All very well for the Umayyads to pose as the heirs of the Ghassanid kings, but Ali was a blood relative of Muhammad. Nothing, then, could have been more damaging to his prestige than to be dismissed as merely a latter-day Lakhmid, the Amir of Hira. As Ali made his way back to Kufa, many of his soldiers seemed simply to have melted away. Kharijites, these deserters were called. Those who go out. What they were decidedly not, however, were deserters from the teachings of the Prophet. Instead, it was Ali whom the Kharijites condemned as the unbeliever, as the man who had strayed from the straight path. The fact that he was Muhammad's nephew only confirmed them in the militancy of their egalitarianism, that the true aristocracy was one of piety and not of blood. Even a companion of the Prophet, if he did not pray until he developed marks on his forehead comparable to the calluses of a camel, if he did not look pale and haggard from regular fasting, if he did not live like a lion by day and a monk by night, ranked in the opinion of the Kharijites as no better than an apostate. Those who reject God after believing in him, so the Prophet had warned, and open their hearts to disbelief, will have the wrath of God upon them, and a grievous punishment awaiting them. Here was a ruling that the Kharijites were more than willing to help enforce. So it was, for instance, that a band of them, meeting an aged companion of the Prophet outside Basra, were said to have demanded that he renounce his loyalty to Ali. And when the companion refused, they butchered him over the carcass of a pig, slit open the belly of his pregnant concubine, and murdered her three attendants. Other Kharijites, so it was reported, might go out with their swords into the markets while people would stand around not realizing what was happening. They would shout, "No judgment except God," and plunge their blades into whomever they could reach, and go on killing until they themselves were killed. A militant devotion to the Prophet's teachings indeed, and fit for that reason, in the opinion of many of their fellow Muhajirun, profoundly to be admired. But not in the opinion of Ali. Abandoning his attempt to bring Muawiyah to heel, he made it his priority instead to extirpate the Kharijites. In 658, he won a victory over them as crushing as it was to prove Pyrrhic, for all he had done, in effect, was to fertilize the soil of Iraq with the blood of their martyrs. 3 years later, and there came the inevitable blowback. A Kharijite assassin struck him down while he was praying in Kufa. The Prophet's dream of brotherhood, of a shared community of believers, seemed dealt a fatal blow too. Into the breach, with great smoothness, stepped Muawiyah. With Ali gone, no one in Iraq now had the resources to oppose him. Even Hassan, Ali's eldest son and his obvious heir as imam, was persuaded to retract his claim and retire on a pension to Medina. With him, too, went his younger brother, Hussein, who, as a boy, so it was said, had been a particular favourite of the Prophet and been dangled lovingly on his knee. True, the removal from Kufa of the two grandsons of Muhammad did not neutralise all opposition to Muawiyah. The Kharijites, on principle, remained obdurately opposed to Umayyad rule. So, too, did many Kufans, who preserved a ferocious loyalty to their murdered emir. Yet Muawiyah, who had not the slightest intention of basing himself in Kufa, could afford to ignore both the Kharijites and the Shia, or party of Ali. Annoyances they might be, but only in the manner of distantly buzzing wasps. The gaze of Muawiyah was fixed not upon a scurvy ragbag of desert Arabs, but upon altogether worthier opponents. Even though the last hint of resistance from the House of Sasan had been crushed back in 651, with the murder of Yazdegerd in that great eastern stronghold of his dynasty, Merv, the Romans, despite all their losses, still stood defiant. Muawiyah, looking to keep the Muhajirun busy, duly renewed the onslaught against the Christian Empire with a vengeance. In 674, he even sponsored a siege of Constantinople itself. In the event, after a blockade of 4 years, the effort to capture the new Rome had to be abandoned. Yet what was striking, perhaps, was not its failure, but how close it had come to success. Certainly, there could be no denying that Muawiyah, in the scope and sweep of his achievements, in the awesome scale of his authority, and in the radiant splendour of his name, was patently a favourite of God. But which God, precisely? Shrewd and calculating as he was in all his dealings with mortal powers, Muawiyah seems to have practised a certain opportunism in his dealings with the heavens, too. Although he termed himself Commander of the Faithful, in succession to Umar and Uthman, his definition of who actually ranked as members of the Faithful was altogether more subtle and ambiguous than theirs had been. Rather than gathering to hail his accession at Medina, the Arabs had assembled in the shadow of the Temple Mount, for Muawiyah had refused to go to the seat of Muhammad. Not even Umar, the emir whose attentions to the sacred rock had seen him hailed by Jews as their redeemer, had thought to demonstrate to quite such flamboyant effect the abiding status of Jerusalem as the holiest city in the world. Muawiyah, however, in providing this reassurance, was concerned principally to woo not his Jewish, but his Christian subjects. That the Arabs, in their original assault upon Palestine, had fought in alliance with Jews was now, to the new King of the Holy Land, something of an embarrassment. Both his tax base and his bureaucracy, after all, were composed primarily of Christians. The Jews could hardly compare. So it was, in addition to receiving the submission of the Arabs, that he had made sure to mark his investiture as commander of the faithful by going on pilgrimage around Jerusalem in the footsteps of Christ. And he went up and sat down on Golgotha and prayed there. Evidently, that the prophet had declared the crucifixion a fraud bothered Muawiyah not a bit. In fact, there is precious little evidence that Muawiyah paid much attention to the prophet at all. Nowhere in his inscriptions, nor on his coins, nor in any of the documents preserved from his reign, is there so much as a single mention of Muhammad. Nor, despite the much later tradition that would attribute the compilation of the prophet's revelations to Uthman, are there any Qurans, or even fragments of Qurans, datable to Muawiyah's lifetime either. Records of the words spoken by Muhammad, twigs of the burning bush aflame with God, must surely have been preserved by those who still tended the light of his memory. The Muhajirun of Kufa, the Shia of Ali, the Kharijites. But the flame was guttering. Like Mani and Mazdak before him, Muhammad was a prophet whose memory had begun to fade before the encroaching shadow of the years. What value the example of his makeshift desert state, after all, to the ruler of an empire that had swallowed up the world? It was not the prophet whom Muawiyah cast as the interpreter of God to man, but himself. Let the faithful profit by him. Such was the prayer raised by his servants. Christians, too, and Jews, and Samaritans, and Manichaeans, all of them, in Muawiyah's opinion, were to be ranked as the faithful, and all of them duly joined in the praise. Savagely though Muawiyah prosecuted his wars against the Romans, yet his subjects, no longer trampled by rival armies, no longer divided by hostile watchtowers, knew only peace at last. Perhaps it's hardly surprising, then, that they seem not to have begrudged the Amir his immodest claim to stand between humanity and God. Justice flourished in his time, and there was great peace in the regions under his control. He allowed everyone to live as they wanted. Such, it must have seemed, was to be the future. A globe-spanning empire of many faiths, and none of them any longer with the whip hand. Chapter 7. The Forging of Islam. God's Deputy. In 679, almost 20 years after Muawiyah had sat and prayed at Golgotha, a Frankish bishop named Arculf arrived in Jerusalem for his own tour of the city's sights. The stresses and convulsions of the age had failed to fracture one of Christianity's most innovative presumptions, that pilgrimage to its holy places was as much for those who lived on the edge of the world as it was for locals. Even though Jerusalem's tourist trade was greatly diminished from what it had been in its heyday, the city still seemed to the wide-eyed bishop to be positively heaving with crowds of all different peoples, with beasts of burden too, and in such numbers that Arculf found himself clutching his nose and sloshing uncomfortably through the filth from their discharges, which spreads everywhere across the streets. Not, of course, that a pilgrim hardened by a grueling journey from Gaul was likely to be thrown off his stride by a few droppings, and sure enough, Arculf proved himself a tireless enthusiast for the city's many wonders. The highlight, inevitably, was the Church of the Resurrection, a shrine unimpaired in its magnificence, the bishop was delighted to discover, since the time of Constantine. Indeed, to an out-of-towner such as Arculf, it might have seemed that Roman rule had never ended. The travel documents issued to him were written in Greek, The coins in his purse were weighted according to standards set by the mints of Constantinople. Many of them were even stamped with that ultimate symbol of the Christian Empire, a cross. Power in the Holy Land still sported a decidedly Roman look. Naturally, Arculf was not oblivious to the recent changing of the guard. News of the calamities afflicting the new Rome had circulated to sensational effect in Gaul. It was widely reported that the Saracens had laid waste entire provinces, as was their habit. Even Jerusalem, that incomparable city of churches, was branded with the stamp of their rule. In the celebrated place, where once the temple arose in its magnificence, Arculf noted, the Saracens now have a quadrangular prayer house. He was almost certainly describing the building begun by Umar, and still unfinished in the early years of Muawiyah's reign. A mosque, or place of prostration, as the Arabs termed it. That they might apply this designation to any place of worship had certainly done little to lower Christian hackles, for it was clear enough, whatever else the prayer house might be, that it was no church. The supreme blasphemy of its location, of course, only heightened Christian anxiety, as did the fact that there were still Jews, ever optimistic, who clung to the hope that the Arabs were actually restoring the walls of the temple. An infernal project, then, it seemed to most Christians. And sure enough, one monk, taking a peek at the building site, reported seeing the workforce accompanied in their labours by a whole crack squad of demons. Notwithstanding this supernatural assistance, however, the end result did seem rather jerry-built. That, at any rate, was the verdict of Arculf himself. Despite being large enough to accommodate some 3,000 worshippers, the building did not impress the bishop. "They put it up roughly," he complained, "by erecting upright boards and great beams on some ruined remains." Perhaps, however, it took a Frank to notice such things. The barbarians of the West had certainly had a good deal of practice in the art of cannibalizing Roman monuments. Indeed, as Theodoric had demonstrated to notable effect, the entire labor of state-building amid the wreckage of the crumbled empire might easily rank as precisely such a project writ large. Perhaps, then, that is why Arculf, although dismissive of the Saracen's mosque, seems not to have been greatly startled by it, nor by their presence in Jerusalem. Although Muawiyah had risen to become incomparably mighty, yet the difference between him and Arculf's own king, back in Gaul, was one of quality, not of kind. Saracens and Franks both lived like squatters amid the splendours of a vanished greatness. No matter that this inheritance from the past was immeasurably richer and more imposing in the East than in the West, the helplessness of the Saracens to improve upon it seemed no less than that of the Franks. Patched together as it was out of brick and wood, Muawiyah's palace inspired eye-rolling paroxysms of condescension in Roman ambassadors. "The ceiling will do for birds," one sniffed, "and the walls will do for rats." Even the great ambition of Muawiyah's life, the capture of Constantinople, spoke of cultural cringe. Fueling it was an unspoken acknowledgement of the Romans' own perennial conceit, that a man could truly rule the world only from the city of Constantine. Yet in one sense, despite the failure of Muawiyah's assault on Al-Qustantinia, his pretensions had already surpassed those of the Caesars. Not even Justinian, at his most megalomaniacal, had presumed to pose as an intercessor between the great toiling mass of humanity and God himself. Clearly, then, in Muawiyah's precocious conception of monarchy, there were influences coming to bear that owed nothing to Roman example. Was it mere coincidence, for instance, that he should have cast himself in a relationship to God so similar to that played by angels in the prayers of the Mushrikun? Assuredly, a ready supply of building materials was far from the limit of what the Fertile Crescent had to offer invaders. Richer as well than anything to be found in the West was its immense array of faiths. Theodoric, keen to distinguish himself from the emperor in Constantinople and from his own Roman subjects, had lived and died an Arian. Muawiyah, the lord of Chalcedonian and Monophysite Christians, of Jews and Samaritans, of Zoroastrians and Manichaeans, had far more options available to him. Above all, in the swirl of beliefs that was his inheritance as an Arab, he possessed something formidably precious, an assurance of God's favour that owed nothing to Rome or to any other earthly power. That he was perfectly content to pray at the site of the crucifixion, or to restore Edessa's cathedral after it had been toppled by an earthquake, or to have the odd public inscription on a bathhouse adorned with a cross, implied not that he was a Christian, but rather that he shared in that respect for Jesus, and for the Jewish prophets too, which had once united Muhammad and the Mushrikun. Whatever the precise doctrines in which Muawiyah put his trust, though, they were certainly not supported by anything that could compare with the massive buttressing that rabbis, bishops, and maobeds over the course of the centuries had erected around their faiths. Nothing as yet had been fashioned out of the various teachings and traditions held sacred by the Arab conquerors that a Christian would have recognized as a religio, a religion. Instead, like blazing points of fire scattered by a starburst, there was a whole shimmering flamescape of sects. For a global monarch such as Muawiyah, this was opportunity on a scale that not even Constantine had enjoyed. In his determination to understand why God had graced him with the rule of the world, and what best might be done to ensure that rule's perpetuation, he could toy with beliefs and doctrines that were still very much up for grabs. Muawiyah, nevertheless, was not alone in seeking to capitalize on this opportunity. In Iraq, at a safe distance from both his direct authority and the gravitational pull of the Holy Land, the urgent question of what, precisely, God wanted from his people had prompted a quite bewildering array of responses. The Kharijites, as militant as ever in their loathing for anything that smacked of monarchy, had retreated from Kufa to the deserts around the Persian Gulf, where they had founded a series of tiny terrorist republics. Meanwhile, their old adversaries, the Shia of Ali, still clung to their own passionately held convictions. There were some partisans of Muhammad's murdered cousin, taking a leaf out of the Sasanian book, who had even begun to claim that only under the command of a leader who shared directly in his bloodline could the world of men hope to know true order and be assured of the favour of God. Others went further still and proclaimed themselves prophets. One of these, an illiterate tailor who claimed to be the heir of both Jesus and Muhammad, and to have a book from heaven that proved it, was eventually cornered by an imperial task force and vanished into a hole that mysteriously opened in the side of a mountain. Finally, aged but hedged about still by the numinous, there were the last remaining Shahaba, the companions of Muhammad. The most celebrated of these, a Qurashi aristocrat by the name of Abdullah ibn al-Zubayr, had been just 8 years old when the prophet had died, but his admirers still revered him as a living link to a more heroic and God-touched age. Certainly his disdain for the Umayyads knew no bounds. For some 20 years his response to the blasphemy of Muawiyah's reign had been to remain in Medina in a pious and ostentatious sulk and lovingly tend the flame of the prophet's memory. Among people who believe themselves graced by the most sensational revelation imaginable, of a direct intrusion into the fabric of human history by God himself, such rivalries were only to be expected, perhaps. The struggle to make sense of such a mystery, as the prodigious appetite for factionalism of the early Christians had shown, was bound to be a grueling one. Unlike the Church, however, the Muhajirun had not had to wait 3 long centuries before seizing the commanding heights of a mighty empire. They had captured theirs in a matter of decades. As a result, disagreements between the Umayyads and their opponents, although no less fixated on the purposes of God than the conflicts between Marcion and the Ebionites had been, had an extra and ominously geopolitical dimension. When Muawiyah, corpulent and near death, proclaimed that his son, a notorious playboy by the name of Yazid, was God's choice as his successor, the result was not merely widespread shock at the blasphemy, but a jolting lurch towards civil war. It was bad enough, in the opinion of the pious, that Yazid himself was a sinner in respect of his belly and his private parts, and kept a monkey as a pet. More truly shocking was any notion that all the upheavals of the previous 60 years, all the struggles and the stupefying triumphs, might have had as their only object the installation of a dynasty such as the Umayyads upon the throne of the world. As news travelled in April 680 of Muawiyah's death, something else was abroad as well. The baleful spectre of Fitna had returned to stalk the Arabian Empire. Syria, unsurprisingly, held firm for Yazid, but Arabia and Iraq did not. First to raise the banner of rebellion was Hussein, the youngest and by now only surviving grandson of the Prophet. Middle-aged and long since retired from the bear pit of the Fertile Crescent, he made for an improbable warrior. Sure enough, when he led his small band of followers on a sudden dash from Medina to Kufa, the local Umayyad agent found it a simple matter to block their approach. Holed up in a flea-bitten village called Kabala, frustrated in his expectation of support from the Muhajirun of Kufa, and increasingly tormented by thirst, Hussein decided to trust his fate to the will of God. Charging the large army that had boxed him in, he and his pathetic retinue were hacked down amid the unforgiving sands. A squalid end for a grandson beloved of the Prophet. And although, in the long run, his death at the hands of Umayyad heavies would do wonders for his standing as a martyr, in the short term it ensured that Iraq, however precariously, remained under Yazid's control. Meanwhile, back in Medina, an altogether more dangerous adversary had been biding his time. Ibn al-Subayyah, as grim and austere as ever, had very publicly refused to take the oath of allegiance to the new emir. As a result, he, rather than any relative of Ali, had emerged as the most prominent opponent of the Umayyads. Tempers in Medina were not helped by the fact that Yazid's representative in the oasis was none other than the fabulously venal and slippery Marwan. The locals' mistrust of their new governor ran particularly deep. Rumours abounded that it was he, back in the last calamitous days of Uthman's rule, who had advised his uncle to double-cross the Egyptian warband that had come to visit the emir, and thereby goaded it into becoming a lynch mob. Nothing Marwan had done since, during all the years of his tenure as governor of the Hejaz, had helped to improve his reputation for double-dealing. Negotiations between Ibn al-Zubayyah and the Umayyads grew increasingly fractious. By 683, they had broken down for good. Ibn al-Zubayyah damned the new emir as a usurper. As Marwan fled Medina for Syria, Yazid sent a task force in the opposite direction. The rebels made frantic efforts to gird their oasis with fortifications, but their defiance was doomed to prove no more effective than had been that of Hussein at Karbala. Despite some brave resistance, Yazid's army stormed the makeshift ditches and ramparts, wiped out the defenders and seized the city. The stories of what happened next grew ever more blood-bolstered with the telling. The city of the Prophet, it is said, was put to the sword for 3 days, and 9 months on from the sack, over 1,000 babies were born. Ibn al-Zubayyah, however, was not among the dead. Implacable in his piety, and full of threats against the Syrians, whom he claimed were transgressors of the law, he had resolved to make a stand that would truly challenge his opponents to do their worst. Accordingly, rather than wait in Medina to confront Yazid's strike force, he had headed for a spot that was even more redolent of holiness, the House of God. Muslim historians, writing more than a century after the fact, would take for granted, of course, that such a sanctuary was to be identified with Mecca. But nowhere in the writings of contemporaries is this actually said. Instead, all is studied indeterminacy. He came to a certain locality in the south, where their sanctuary was, and lived there. So wrote one Christian chronicler about Ibn al-Zubayr. Evidently, then, the precise location of the Arab's desert shrine remained as much a puzzle to outsiders as it had ever been. Nevertheless, there were certain suggestive clues. It was noted by one bishop, for instance, that the Muhajirun of Iraq, when they bowed to pray, did so towards the west, towards the Kaaba, the primordial wellspring of their race, while those in Alexandria turned to the east. Muslim tradition, too, rather startlingly, recorded something very similar. The founder of the first mosque in Kufa, so it was said, had fired an arrow to determine the Qibla, the direction of prayer. And it had landed not to the south of the mosque in a line with Mecca, but somewhere to its west. So although no contemporary tells us exactly where Ibn al-Zubayr took refuge, the weight of evidence would suggest a location to the north of the Hejaz, midway between Kufa and Alexandria. Since this is precisely the region with which Muhammad himself appears to have been most familiar, and since Ibn al-Zubayr was consciously aiming to defend the Prophet's legacy, the likelihood must surely be that the house of God in which he barricaded himself stood not in Mecca, but between Medina and Palestine, in that blessed place named by the Prophet himself as Baqa. Yet whether all the Arabs, a full half-century on from his death, would necessarily have revered it is another matter. The notion, inherited from Jews and Christians, that a single shrine might be possessed of a holiness so awesome as to merit pilgrimage from every corner of the world, competed in their minds with a radically opposed tradition. All very helpful of a bishop to identify the sanctuary of the Muhajirun as the Kaaba, except, of course, that there were Kaabas reaching from Nabatea to Najran. To glimpse the sacred in a feature, even as relatively mundane as a spring or a well or an oddly coloured stone, was a time-hallowed instinct among the Arabs. And yet, while this indisputably spoke of a sensitivity to the numinous, it also betrayed a certain cavalier attitude towards the status of specific shrines. Over the course of the generations, sanctuaries had repeatedly been staked out as hallowed, haram, and then just as abruptly been abandoned. Even the Prophet, while trying to define the direction in which his followers should pray, had been capable of the occasional volte-face. The foolish people will say, "What has turned them away from the prayer direction they used to face?" What the original Qibla might have been, and what its replacement, the Prophet had not thought to specify. But that one sanctuary had been promoted, and at the expense of another, was clear enough. No wonder, then, descending upon the house of God, that Ibn al-Zubayr should have been concerned to make his voice heard from a distance. After all, with time passing by, with those who could remember the Prophet slipping into oblivion, and with the double-dealing Umayyads preening themselves amid the magnificent and seductive monuments of Christian Jerusalem, who was to say how long the memory, let alone the primacy, of Baqa could be kept alive? In the event, two accidents would serve to boost Ibn al-Zubayr in his ambitions for the site. The first of these, paradoxically, might have seemed to spell its doom. In the summer of 683, with Yazid's army camped out before the house of God, the Kaaba, it is said, caught fire and burned to the ground. Some blamed this calamity on torches hurled by the Syrians, others on Ibn al-Zubayr's own clumsiness, but all are agreed on the ruinous extent of the damage. And so, perhaps, the sanctuary might well have been left as nothing but blackened rubble, had not the second accident then intervened. Yazid, back in Syria, keeled over and died. The news, when it reached the task force, left them abruptly shiftless. With Yazid's death, they felt themselves doubly bereft, not only of their imam, but of the favour of God. Not so Ibn al-Zubayr, of course. He, with his great enemy dead, could now feel even more soaringly justified in all his pretensions. When Yazid's army, scouting around for a new amir, promised him their loyalty if he would only accompany them to Syria, Ibn al-Zubayr indignantly refused. He had higher things by far on his mind. As the Syrians drifted aimlessly away from their siege, Ibn al-Zubayr set about constructing a sanctuary that could serve, without any further compromise or ambiguity, as a fit object for the veneration of all the faithful. Taking a pick in his own hands, it is said, he levelled what remained of the incinerated shrine and raised an entirely new one in its place. The whiff of paradox in this was palpable, even by the standards of the Arabs, a people who traditionally had always been perfectly content to abandon sanctuaries with barely a second thought. A question as obvious as it was unsettling shadowed Ibn al-Zubayr's labours. How precisely could his new house of God be reckoned timeless when it had only just been erected? His propagandists, it would appear, had not stinted in providing answers. Centuries on from Ibn al-Zubayr's great building project, fantastical stories of the discoveries that were made during the course of the excavations would still be lovingly repeated. It was said that the original foundations, laid down by Abraham, had been miraculously brought to light. A mysterious text had been found, guaranteeing divine favour for all who visited the sanctuary. Most sensationally of all, when a black stone had been dug up, the whole sanctuary had begun to tremble. On this stone, so some reported, had been stamped the very name and title of God. I am Allah, the Lord of Baqa. And, as with the house of God, so with the great empire beyond. Ibn al-Zubayr aimed to set it on new foundations. Just as fire had left the Kaaba a crumbling ruin, fitna had come to ravage the world. In Syria, Yazid had been succeeded by his son, an infant so sickly that he had died after only a couple of months on the throne. Amid the resulting power vacuum, the Arabs had once again begun to turn upon themselves. Partisans of Ali, in mourning for Hussein, vented their sense of mingled grief and shame upon the garrisons of the hated Umayyads. Kharijite warbands, fanning out across southern Iraq, renewed their campaign of shadowy and calculated terror. In Kufa, a charismatic figure, whom posterity would damn as Mukhtar the Deceiver, seized the city's treasury, distributed its entire reserve of 9 million coins to the poor, and urged a revolution in which all men were to be equal, claiming he was a prophet. He provoked particular excitement by parading a brocade-draped chair, which his enemies ridiculed as a piece of junk looted from Ali's attic, but which enthusiasts, taking a leaf out of a thoroughly Jewish book, hailed as a manifestation of the presence of God himself, the Shekinah. The presence of this fabulous totem on campaign, either carried on a grey donkey or borne aloft into battle by litter-bearers, proved not surprisingly a potent boost to Mukhtar's record as both a general and a prophet. It helped as well that Mukhtar himself, whenever he charged his enemies, was said to be accompanied by a bodyguard of angels mounted on horses of flame. In the face of such wild and competing enthusiasms, the frameworks of governance just lately restored by Muawiyah began once again to buckle. The antagonisms unleashed by the fitna proved relentless, the hatreds bewildering, the violence exhausting and savage. Much, after all, was at stake. To the venerable thrill of tribal rivalries, still potent as these were among the various Arab emigrants, had been added whole new dimensions of chauvinism. Factionalists, when they chose an imam or a prophet to follow, were choosing as well what their fate in the next world was to be. And so it was when they fought, that they would invariably do so to the death. Once again, as in the time of the great war between Heraclius and Khusro, or that of the first coming of the Arabs, the sense was palpable of a conflict in which more, very much more, was at stake than mere earthly ambitions. Even those whose fate it was to cower as impotent bystanders before the agonies of the age were alert to this. War was far from being the only expression of God's anger. Plague, too, had returned to Iraq, strewing roads with the dead and polluting the canals and rivers with corpses. Pestilence, in turn, led to famine. Children with limbs like dry sticks of wood would graze on withered grass, while mothers, it was darkly rumoured, might feed on their own babies. Worst of all were the looters, from whom no one could escape, for they wandered about everywhere, following their prey like gleaners, hauling them out of hidden places and stripping them of their belongings and leaving them naked. It could be hard to tell the difference between such bandits, the Kharijites and Mukhtar's cudgel-bearers. Humanity, like monsters of the deep, was preying on itself. Events once again appeared to be portending the end of days. Certainly, whether such an eventuality were imminent or not, it was the divinely appointed duty of Ibn al-Zubayr as commander of the faithful to prepare the world for it. Nearer to mankind their reckoning draws, and yet in heedlessness they turn away. So the prophet had lamented. Ibn al-Zubayr, in hearkening to this ominous warning, made sure to take decisive steps. Doing as Umar and Uthman had done, and directing the affairs of the world from the depths of the desert, he sent his brother, Musab, to bring order to Iraq. Musab undertook this seemingly thankless commission with efficiency and relish. Mukhtar, that preacher of an unsettlingly radical egalitarianism, was briskly defeated, cornered in the governor's palace and put to death. His severed hand, a trophy for the faithful to admire on their way to prayers, was nailed to the side of Kufa's mosque, while his holy chair was consigned to a bonfire. Simultaneously, across the south of Iraq, the far bloodier and more exhausting task of suppressing the Kharijites inspired Musab to launch a troop surge that reached as far as the Persian uplands. It was not only through a counterinsurgency campaign, however, that Ibn al-Zubayr aimed to bring order to a tottering world. Not every message was to be delivered on the point of a sword. Judgment, so the Kharijite slogan ran, belongs to God alone. Ibn al-Zubayr and his lieutenants, while certainly not disputing this message, aimed to refine it by stating with the utmost clarity just how and when it was that the judgment of God had been made known. So it was, in either 685 or 686, as the fitna continued to rage in Iraq, that one of his lieutenants minted a coin in Persia with a novel and fateful message. Bismillah Muhammad Rasul Allah, it ran. In the name of God, Muhammad is the messenger of God. The potency of this slogan, amid the carnage and confusion of the times, was self-evident. Ibn al-Zubayr's genius was to recognize, as Constantine had recognized long before him, that any lord of a great empire who claimed God's favour must ensure that the basis of that favour stood rock-solid. Military action alone would never serve to bring the fitna to an end. Only a framework of doctrines that all the combatants could accept as authentic and bestowed of God had any hope of achieving that. Hence the supreme value of the example of the prophet. Whereas Constantine at Nicaea had been obliged to depend upon fractious and fallible bishops to stamp a particular brand of his chosen faith as orthodox, Ibn al-Zubayr had identified a far less troublesome sanction. For not only had Muhammad claimed to be a medium for divine revelation, but he was also safely dead. Ram home the point that he had authentically been a messenger of God, and anything that could be attributed to him would perforce have to be accepted by the faithful as a truth descended from heaven. Those who offend the prophet, so it had been revealed to Muhammad, are cursed by God in this life and in the hereafter. Here, for any warlord looking to damn his enemies was a literal godsend. This was why, with Ibn al-Zubayr and his henchmen increasingly alert to its potential, they made ever more play with their new message, that Muhammad had truly been the prophet of God. Far more effectively than any troop surge in Iraq, it seemed to promise them the rule of the world. There was, however, a problem. Ibn al-Zubayr was not the only self-proclaimed commander of the faithful to have spotted the uses to which such a slogan might be put. Widely, though he had established his authority across Arabia, Iraq, and Persia, Syria still stood defiant. There, the Umayyad cause, though scotched, had not been killed. Conditions in the wake of Yazid's death, chaotic as they were, had been ideally suited to the talents of a schemer such as Marwan. At a tribal assembly convened at the old Ghassanid capital of Jabiya in the summer of 684, held to debate whether Ibn al-Zubayr should be acknowledged as Amir, he proposed putting the whole issue to a vote, and so finessed the proceedings that, to much astonishment, it was his own name that came up. Marwan, a man grown old in his pursuit of power, would have only 9 months to enjoy his triumph. But already, by the time he died in the spring of 685, he had done enough to ensure that Syria, at any rate, would remain Umayyad. His successor, hailed enthusiastically by the Syrians as Amir, was also his son, a man in his 40s, notorious for his golden dentures and the foul quality of his halitosis, named Abd al-Malik. The new Amir had talents that extended far beyond an ability to slay flies with a single breath. Abd al-Malik was very much a chip off the Umayyad block. Brutality was seamlessly fused in him with ambition, intelligence, and vision. The same man who could leash a political rival, lead him around like a dog, and then straddle his chest to hack off his head, was also a man who could swallow his own pride sufficiently to pay tribute to the Romans in an effort to secure his northern border, and lurk patiently in Syria, leaving it to Musab to crush the Kharijites and the Shia. Only in 689, 4 years after he had succeeded his father as Amir, did Abd al-Malik finally go on the offensive, doing as Julian had done long before him, and snatching after global empire by invading northern Iraq. Unlike Julian, however, he was to secure fabulous success. In early 691, beneath fluttering banners and swirling dust, he succeeded in bringing Musab to defeat and death. The tribesmen saw clearly the error of their ways, and he straightened out the smirk upon their faces. Yet Abd al-Malik, even as he trampled down the corpse of his rival, did not neglect to heed the lessons of Musab's earlier triumphs in Iraq. Smirks had to be straightened out, but so too, if the conquerors of the far-flung empire were ever to be united as a single people, did their sense of what they owed to God. Abd al-Malik, having wrenched Iraq from Ibn al-Zubayr's grasp, did not hesitate to purloin his slogan as well. Even as the last embers of opposition to Umayyad rule were being stamped out in Basra, new coins were starting to circulate in the city. "In the name of God," they proclaimed, "Muhammad is the messenger of God." The assertion was no less potent for appearing on the coins of an Umayyad. Startling though the sudden emphasis on the prophet's role must have appeared to those in the markets and counting houses of Basra, there is no reason to doubt Abd al-Malik's personal sincerity. Not only had he grown up in Medina, where memories of Muhammad were uniquely vivid and cherished, but his reputation for austere godliness rivaled that of Ibn al-Zubayr. Nevertheless, it's clear as well that his abrupt parading of Muhammad's name, something that no other member of his dynasty had ever thought to do, was prompted by self-interest as well as piety. Concerned as Abd al-Malik was to spike Ibn al-Zubayr's pretensions, he also had an eye fixed on a second adversary. Despite the expediency of the tribute that he had paid to Constantinople, it still rankled as a bitter humiliation, and one that he aimed to wipe clean. What better way, then, than by striking directly at the heart of Roman conceit? Muawiyah, despite his unwearying appetite for dyeing the Christian empire with blood, had never thought to dispute with his adversaries the truth of their faith. Abd al-Malik, however, suffered from no such inhibition. Not for him a respectful pilgrimage to Golgotha. Rather than soothing Christian sensibilities by professing a vague brand of monotheism, he sought to rub Roman noses in the obvious inferiority of their superstitions. As surely as Muawiyah had sought the annihilation of Constantinople's worldly power, Abd al-Malik aimed to shred her claim to a special relationship with God. A radical and far from easy step to take. Just as the strategy of challenging the Romans by sea had required the building of entire fleets from scratch, disputing the highway to heaven with them would demand truly formidable feats of innovation. Out of the scattered flotsam and jetsam of beliefs left scattered by the great flood tide of Arab conquests, something coherent, something manifestly God-stamped, would have to be fashioned. In short, a religion. And if the enshrining of Muhammad as its founder was a start, then it was only that, a start. No better way to appreciate the full scale of what remained to be done than to visit the city where Abd al-Malik, like Muawiyah before him, had first been saluted as Amir, Jerusalem. There, where the radiance of candles in the churches burned so bright that, by night, the entire city and the hills that surrounded it appeared as one great dazzling blaze of light, the splendour of Christianity and the heft of its antiquity remained intimidating things. Well might Abd al-Malik, noting the scale of the dome of the Church of the Resurrection and its magnificence, have been moved lest it dazzle the minds of the faithful. Yet the possession of Jerusalem, although certainly a challenge, presented an opportunity, too. Even as Abd al-Malik was leading his armies to victory in Iraq, workmen on the Temple Mount were busy labouring to secure him an equally brilliant triumph. The ramshackle mosque sniffed at so disdainfully by Arkulf had been demolished, and was now being replaced in sumptuous style. A wall was being built around the limits of the rock to mark it out as Haram, and gates set in the wall opened on to upgraded roads. Most stupefying of all, however, and most wondrously beautiful too, was an octagonal building of such prominence as to put even the Church of the Resurrection in the shade. That this was a deliberate ploy could hardly have been made any more emphatic. Not only did the dimensions of the new structure exactly replicate those of Constantine's great church, but its piers were to be surmounted, when completed, by a vast, gilded cupola. Yet what really served to fling back in the teeth of Christians all their arrogance and their pretensions was the deliberate positioning of this same dome of the rock. Enclosed within it, its surface unadorned and bare, was the perforated expanse of stone over which the Roman authorities had permitted a ragbag of sobbing Jews to blow their ram's horns each year. Just as the rabbis had identified this spot with the Shekinah, the imminence of the divine on earth, Abd al-Malik and his architects attributed to it a no less awesome role. At the beginning of time, they believed, with the universe just completed, God had stood upon the rock and then ascended into heaven, leaving behind an imprint of his foot. The end of time, too, would see the rock transfigured, for on the day of judgment, all the faithful and all the mosques across the world, and even the Kaaba itself, were destined to travel to Jerusalem, so that the people will cry, "Hail to you who come as pilgrims, and hail to her to whom the pilgrimage is made." Perhaps, given the seeming imminence of the end days, it was only to be expected that Abd al-Malik should have wished to raise a monument appropriate to the climactic role in them that the rock was destined to play. only to be expected as well, with the House of God still in the hands of Ibn al-Zubayr, that he should have been reluctant to wait for the Day of Judgment before promoting it as a site of pilgrimage. He even went so far as to furnish it with souvenirs of Abraham. As a result, the local Muhajirun had no need to travel into the desert to wonder at relics of their august forefather. Instead, they could journey to the Dome of the Rock and see hanging there the desiccated horns of the ram that Abraham had supposedly offered up in sacrifice on the very spot. Sure enough, among his immediate subjects, Abd al-Malik's grand projet proved a quite stunning success. All the rough Arabs of Syria, so a Kharijite sneered, go to it on pilgrimage. What was the Dome of the Rock, so locals might boast, if not the holiest spot on earth? Yet there was in this same vaunt a nagging irony. Flattering to Abd al-Malik it may have been, but it also had the potential to be lethal to the broader sweep of his ambitions. It was all very well for inscriptions repeated across the Dome of the Rock to echo the slogan on his coins and proclaim that Muhammad was the messenger of God, but it begged a most awkward question. Since the Prophet had never stepped foot in Jerusalem, how could any notion of the Temple Mount as the holiest spot on earth be squared with Abd al-Malik's simultaneous promotion of Muhammad as the founder of his infant religion? Inexorably, though the years had slipped by, and hazy though memories of the Prophet had become, yet there could be no forgetting that he had dwelt beyond the limits of Palestine. Clearly, then, Abd al-Malik could not afford to do as the Roman and Persian authorities had done, and simply leave the depths of the desert well alone. He had no option but to go after Ibn al-Zubayr. His rivals continued hold upon the holy places where the Prophet had received his revelations, affronted not only Abd al-Malik's authority, but that of the heavens themselves. Jerusalem on its own would never be adequate to the full purposes of his mission. He urgently needed Arabia as well. Otherwise, without it, what prospect of fashioning what Abd al-Malik devoutly believed himself set on earth to complete, the authentic religion of truth? In the autumn of 691, an army of some 2,000 men duly set off from Kufa into the desert. Abd al-Malik, whose eye for talent was not a whit inferior to all his many other capabilities, had appointed his most trusted servant as its commander, a youthful former schoolteacher by the name of al-Hajjaj. Not for nothing was this brilliantly able young man known as Little Dog. Ugly and diminutive he may have been, but his nose for a scent was outstanding, and his teeth were razor-sharp. By the spring of 692 he had cornered his quarry. Once again, Ibn al-Zubayr found himself holed up inside a house of worship. This time, though, there was to be no reprieve. Al-Hajjaj blockaded the old man for 6 months, pulverizing his defences with catapults to such lethal effect that by autumn the entire sanctuary had once again been reduced to rubble and left littered with corpses, one of which was Ibn al-Zubayr's. The whole of Arabia was finally Abd al-Malik's. 2 years later, the emir himself journeyed through the desert on an ostentatious pilgrimage. Already lord of the Temple Mount, where the Dome of the Rock had been completed in the same year as the defeat of Ibn al-Zubayr, he now also claimed dominion over a site equally awesome and sacred. To us, as a court poet wrote in celebration of his glittering achievement, belong two houses, the House of God, of which we are the governors, and the revered house on the Mount of Jerusalem. Yet here once again was a telling ambiguity. No mystery as to the location of the Dome of the Rock, of course, but where precisely was the enigmatic